Our parasha begins Vayeshev Yaakov Be'eretz Mugurei Aviv. For whatever bizarre reason, I started our sources one pasuk after that. Yaakov settled, Vayeshev Yaakov. Yaakov settled Be'eretz Mugurei Aviv. He settles in a place that, as far as his parents, grandparents were concerned, it's a place that they lived, but the connotation of migurei, lagur, ger, gar, has a connotation sometimes of strangeness. And over here, the yeshiva is one of being settled versus one of being a stranger. So when we compare the two forms over here, vayeshev Yaakov, Yaakov settled in a place where be'eretz migurei aviv, in a place where his parents and grandparents may have felt more like strangers. And I think that this issue of strangeness experienced by Avraham, I mean, when, yes, God gave him the land, and we've discussed this, I think, that when it comes to bury Sarah, he has no place to bury her. Yes, all the land is his, but that's in the future. Right now, he doesn't even have a burial place, and that gives some of that intrigue. Yitzhak will own the land, but that's great, but they keep filling up the wells and so on and so forth. So even though he has ownership, but the ownership is one where it's all part of the futures market and not part of what's the reality of what they have right now. But with Yaakov, we if we're not mistaken, we hear a shift, and the shift is Vayeshev Yaakov Eretz Mugurei. Yaakov settled or tried to settle. Over here is where Rashi makes his very famous comment, even though when you look for it, it's not there, because it's not on this pasuk, it's on the next pasuk. Rashi talks about how Bikesh Yaakov Leshevet B'Shalva, the Yaakov really wanted to settle with tranquility. He wanted something more than he ended up getting, which means this is the introduction to problem. I mean, Yaakov wanted to settle, so I think a real good word to use would, what happens next will be incredibly unsettling and will cause Yaakov's whole life to really shatter in front of him. One of the things that the Gemara says about Yaakov, especially compared to Avraham and Yitzchak, who did not necessarily have the easiest lives themselves, but it says that Yaakov had tsar gidul banim. Yaakov knew what it was like to raise children. He had a hard time. He had a hard time with his children. And you can begin to consider which child and, you know, take your pick. Yet Yaakov does not have an easy time with his children, whether it's Reuven, whether it's Shimon, whether it's Levi, whether it's Yehuda, whether and Dina, and we can keep on going down the line. Yaakov seems to have, you know, a quite difficult time. And as I said, the Gemara says about Yaakov, Yaakov knows what it's like to raise children. Yaakov experienced what the Gemara calls tsar gidul banim, the difficulty of raising children. Now, the larger question that I want to deal with today is actually one of those children. It's not the child who you think it is, because of course today the focus will be on Yosef. So I'm not going to focus on Yosef. I'm going to focus on a different child. But in order to understand why I'm focusing on a different child, we need to go a little bit broader and to understand what may very well be the context here. And this is one of the things that when we read, and this is, you know, something we've said many times, when we look at the parasha and we start Vayeshev, so then we look at it within certain really limited parameters, just to see what I'm about to say, we have really two verses which are of interest to me here to start off. Vayeshev Yaakov, which we already read, and the next one, Elo Toldot Yaakov, and these are the generations of Yaakov. If we turn back, and I don't know if all of you can, because you don't have it in front of you, if we turn back, we have by Esav, the beginning of the previous chapter, Perek Lamed Vav, Ve'Elo Toldot Esav. So over here we have Elo Toldot Yaakov, and there we have Elo Toldot Esav. Now if you ask me which one of them make more sense, there's no question in my mind the Esav one makes more sense, which may be a strange thing to say, because this verse is a very disjointed verse, the one that we have in front of us. Elo Toldot Yaakov Yosef Ben Shvasrei Shana, which means, hold it, I skipped something. Elo Toldot Yaakov, when I just go back one chapter and compare it, the Elo Toldot Esav Hu Edom. Now first of all, that's very interesting, because it just now gave me two different names. It gave me the personal private name of Esav, but when Esav becomes a nation, he's not known as the nation of Esav, he's known as the nation of Edom. So Eile Toldot Esav Hu Edom. If, by the way, if that's the case, then how should have this verse have read? Obviously it should have read, Eile Toldot Yaakov Hu Yisrael. Right? That would have been the real appropriate parallel between the two sections. It then goes and tells us about Esau's entire genealogy, his various wives, his various children that he has. It also tells us, Vayikach Esau et Nashav et Banav et Benotav et Kol Nefashot Beito et Mikneil et Kol Behemtov et Kol Kinyano Asher Rachash Beretz Kanaan Vayelech Eretz Mepnei Yaakov Achiv. He left the land of Israel because of Yaakov. Ki Aruch Hashem Rav Mishevet Yachtav, which reminds us, of course, of Avram and Lot. V'lo yichla eretz mugurim l'seit otam b'nei mikneim. Well, again, it sounds just like the Lot Avram. And you know what the next pasuk says? V'yeshev Esav behar Seir. So anything to say about v'yeshev Yaakov, where you have, again, v'yeshev Yaakov, Eila toldot Yaakov, here you have Eila toldot Esav, and here you have v'yeshev Esav behar Seir Esav hu Edom, which again talks about this tension between the personal and the national. And that's really what I want you to think about and to focus on, which means when we're talking about Esav, which it's, again, so abundantly clear, unfortunately, when we read about Yaakov, it's not abundantly clear, what I'm pointing out now. Again, the individual, the national, the toldot, the lineage, and then there's one more thing, which is, I think, quite important. It talks about the various alufim. I saw a translation this week. Alufim is the dukes of Esav. I thought that was great. The dukes of Esav was actually a translation by Rabbi Kahana's father, Rabbi Yecheskel Kahana. The Eila Hamalachim. Now I'm reading from, again a little bit previously from where we're up to. It's towards the end of Perek Lamed Vav, but you cannot read this pasuk without doing what I've just now been doing, and that's the contrast. Till now, I said the contrast, I have to point it out. Oh, toldot Esav, toldot Yaakov, vayeshev, vayeshev. But now this verse you can't miss, unless you miss it. And it says, ve'eila hamalachim, and these are the kings, asher mofu be'eretz Edom, who ruled in the land of Edom, again, Esav's national name, lifnei malach melech livnei Yisrael. Before there was a king of the Jewish people. So therefore, what we have is a latoldot vayeshev, kings. Therefore, I just want to put forth, I'm not even going to say this is a theory. It's only a theory if nobody else said it. I don't know if anybody said it, but it's not a theory. So I have an old chavruta who listened to one of my shirim last week, and he says, it's one thing you say what you say, another thing that you try to convince people it's pshat. So I will be guilty of that again. This isn't a theory. This is pshat. The pshat over here in the beginning of Vayeshev, it cannot be read without the end of Vayetze. It cannot be read with... Sorry, not Vayishlach. It cannot be read without the end of Vayishlach. It cannot be read without the comparison and contrast with Esav. And now I realize that there is the following tension. They are individuals and there are nations. And it's always complicated when you're someplace in between the two. And also, let's not fool ourselves. You know, sometimes we read in Chumash that there was this king of this place, this king of that place. And I don't know what we imagine kings, or, you know, it's not exactly like the Queen of England, you know, where you have all these subjects, actually real and imagined. I think they still think they have Canada and Australia and whatever. Okay, I'm not going to say anything. But I'll say it again, that you have all these subjects real and imagined, but there's really a lot of people. You have millions of people. It could be that sometimes in the Chumash, when it talks about the king of a place, you're talking about a clan. You're talking about, you know, a couple dozens of people, hundreds of people. You're not necessarily talking about something which is, you know, continents. So, and I think that's important to note that the concept of ruling is not necessarily what we think, but it's over here, yes, Edom will one day become a nation, and Yisrael will one day become a nation. And all that we're being told over here is that we got a little jump start on the national part. It could be that when you deal with the Edoms of the world, which rule by power, so therefore who is going to become a ruler or a king emerges very quickly. The first time we find anybody who's any kind of ruler is Nimrod, who's very much an Esav type of character. So you have those who want to rule a certain type of personality. Nonetheless, nonetheless by Israel. It's going to happen at some point. And how do I know it's going to happen? Well, first of all, it has to happen because you need leadership because you can't have anarchy. Not that I need leadership because I want to control somebody else. I need leadership to avoid anarchy, which again are two different types of approaches to, I guess, to the political. So, with that whole introduction, now we can start Vayeshev again, because now I've given you a little bit more of a format that we should be looking, or things we should be looking for. And of course you can accuse me of reading into it, but maybe the question now really should be, the question should be, so who will be king? Now, even if you don't like the question, who will be king, you can switch it. If you, on the one hand, you can say, who will be leader? Or if you want to go crazy and theological on me, then you can say, who will be Mashiach? Because Mashiach is actually the ultimate culmination of the kingship of Beit David. So again, what we just now did is we just went in completely different directions from somebody who's going to be ruling over to somebody who will be bringing the world to its apex. So those are such different concepts. So over here, even, these are the kings in Edom before there was a king in Israel, because it could very well be that the kingship of Israel is just a completely different type of dynamic. So now we've put everything out for you, so now all we have to do is fill in the details. Correct? Correct. So once again, Vayeshev Yaakov, Eretz Migurei Aviv, Eretz Canaan, and now we can start what we have in front of us. Ela toldot Yaakov Yosef. So that now, right away, we need to know that this verse is awkward. Every other time we've had Ela toldot, it has been far more complete. Over here, it's almost deliberately saying, this is the lineage of Yaakov and not the others. Now, if I were then now to ask you the obvious question based on everything I've said till now, so who is, as far as we're concerned right now, the best candidate to one day become leader? So the answer to the question is Yosef. And I'm saying, you can't read, again, I'm overstating this again, you can't read this verse any other way. As I said, there's no other way to read this. If I want to strengthen this, I can say, of course this is the case. Rachel was the only one that he ever wanted to marry. This is his true wife. This is his true child. This is his true legacy. Continue. Ela told it Yaakov Yosef ben Shvasrei Shana, Hayaroa et Echav Batzon. What an interesting turn of phrase. That Yosef is the shepherd. He shepherded his brothers. So and again, within a Jewish biblical sense of what is a leader is a shepherd. So Yosef is the one who shepherds his brothers. So right there, staring at you, is this formulation of leadership. And this is a bit more curious. Rashi takes us in one direction. And by the way, that's one of our blessings that we have Rashi to explain so many things to us, and it's one of our curses that we sometimes forget to what the Chumash actually says. So, v'hu na'ar, what does it mean? So Rashi has this as a non sequitur. Oh, that he acted in an immature way, and he used to curl his hair, and what does that mean? V'hu na'ar et b'nei bilha b'nei zilpa. It's not that something independent, hu na'ar. He was immature, et b'nei zilpa b'nei zilpa, which means you can't read it that way. The word na'ar is used later on in the Chumash to describe the relationship between Yehoshua and Moshe. That Yehoshua was the second in command for Moshe, right? That the na'ar Yehoshua would never leave Moshe's tent. He was the one who was second in command. He was the one who implemented Moshe's will. He was the one who helped Moshe and everything. And if that's the reading over here, then what we have in front of us instead is a statement of leadership, and that hu na'ar, Ela toldot Yaakov Yosef. So what is Yosef then? He's an extension of Yaakov. Who is Yosef? He is his right hand. He's the extension. He's the leader. V'hu na'ar b'nei bilha b'nei zilpa, which again is a little strange. Neshe aviv. Continue. V'yove Yosef ediba tamra'a el avihim. And Yosef would bring the bad reports to his father, and other bad reports of who? So I just want to point out that there's a couple of things that just to really understand the pshat over here. Ediba tamra'a could be talking about B'nai Bilha, B'nai Zilpa, which I don't believe it is, and I'll explain why in a moment. But it also could be talking about Hu Ro'e et Echav Batzon. So therefore, Edibatam goes back to Echav. Okay? Now, why would I say that? So that's what we need now to break down a little more. Did anybody notice anything absolutely remarkable about the way that Yosef treats the B'nai Bilhah, B'nai Zilpah? Who na'ar at B'nai Bilhah, B'nai Zilpah? He leads, yeah?
Who na'ar can be a 17-year-old.
But it still seems to be this point of leadership when we go back to the previous verse, and then there is this diba in the middle. There was something else right there which was really quite important that we missed. And once we realize what we missed, then everything else will start to fall into focus. What we missed is back in Perek Lamed Hey, and I think this will be the last time I go backwards. Back in Perek Lamed Hey, Pasuk Kaf Bet, it says something, and again I'll say that because of Rashi's influence on us, anybody who learned in yeshiva cannot know what this verse says, and I'll give you a hint. The verse actually says what it says. It says, "Vayihi bishkon Yisrael be'eretzahi." Vayihi bishkon Yisrael be'eretzahi. By the way, what did you notice so far about the word? Which word was used? Yisrael was used. Vayelech Ruvain, vayishkav et Bilha, pilegish aviv, vayishma Yisrael. And the next, and the continuation of the same pasuk. Vayihu b'nei Yaakov shneimasar. How's that for an annoying pasuk? First of all, what's annoying? It just now shifted in the middle between Yisrael and Yaakov. Two times Yisrael, one times Yaakov. And on top of everything else, the word Yisrael the second time, there was an entnachta, which means we're in the middle of the pasuk, and then there's an enter on the computer, and it jumped down to the next line. This is one of the few times that we have in the middle of a pasuk, it jumps onto a new paragraph, starts in the middle of a pasuk, which is really, really quite strange when you look at it. But what do the pasuk say, and why did I go here? Why is this so interesting in terms of what we just now read about Yosef's orientation to the B'nai Bilhah and B'nai Zilpah? Did you notice and by the way, if you don't notice this, you don't know what's going on. If you notice this, now everything else falls into line. Anybody get it? Exactly. Yes. That Reuven beds Bilhah Pilegish Aviv, the concubine of his father. And the name over here is Yisrael and Yisrael. We'll now have to understand what Reuven was thinking. On the other hand, by Yosef it says, V'hu na'arit b'nei Bilhah b'nei Zilpah nishe Aviv. And afterwards it says, Yosef, Yosef dibatam ra'ah, Yosef would bring the bad reports. Rashi tells us that the B'nai Leah would call the B'nai Bilhah and Zilpah avadim. They would call them avadim. Where did Rashi get that from? So what's the answer? It's black and white in front of us. Again, how is it black and white in front of us? That Reuven considers Bilhah and Zilpah to be themselves concubines less than wives, servants, who happened to get pregnant, and on the other hand, Yosef sees them as being full-fledged brothers.
The king, right. The king David.
Exactly. Exactly. Correct.
King David's
son. Doesn't make a difference. Correct. 100%. Which means once I belabored. We're not giving points here. But for my next book, you can write that. We'll put it on the back cover. Makes more sense than Rashi. That would be great. Now, correct. And that's why I was working so hard to set up this issue of who's going to be king. And king. Once you realize what happens later on in Tanakh, and again, a number of times, where we have children of kings, especially in King David's family, who go and want to take a pilegish of their father to show that they are king, this again, contextually, this becomes so clear. This becomes all black and white. What's going on over here? Reuven is actually, he's doing a couple of things, which is far more clever than we normally give him credit for. On the one hand, there are 12 sons and a daughter. The daughter nobody considers, so let's push her aside. We're down to 12 sons. Sorry. We have 12 sons now. The 12 sons, theoretically, are all candidates to one day be king. So in one action, he's declaring himself to be the heir, and he just now pushed four out of contention. How does he push four out of contention? They're not even real sons. So his orientation over here is that the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah are not real sons of Yaakov. There's something else. and therefore he does what he does with, he gets in bed again. But I know the Gemara says, and this is really what bothers Rashi, and the Gemara actually debates it. There's not one opinion of the Gemara. There's a number of opinions of the Gemara. I mean, if you were to ask me, the dominant opinion of the Gemara is that Reuven sinned. But why can't we say that? Maybe I'll explain why we can't say that. We have a hard time with this. But the Gemara says, according to one opinion, Kol Misha Omer, Reuven Chata in El Toa. Whoever says that Reuven sins is making a mistake. So what's my conclusion? My conclusion is not that he didn't do it. My conclusion is he shouldn't say it. Because who says it? The Chumash says it. So now you're going to tell me that the Chumash is mistaken? Not only does the Chumash say it, Yaakov says it later on. Ki alito mishkavei avicha. Because you got in your father's bed. It doesn't say you moved the bed, you got in the bed. So now I have to say the Chumash is wrong, and Yaakov is wrong, again, and the Chumash is wrong. So I would rather say that Yaakov is right, he was there. I'd rather say the Chumash is right, and say whoever says it is wrong. So that's the only conclusion I have, is that you shouldn't say it. But that doesn't mean it doesn't happen. And by the way, I'll tell you why you shouldn't say it. You shouldn't say it because arguably Reuven later on recanted, and Reuven did tshuva, and Reuven changed. So now we have the problem of somebody who became a Baal tshuva. Do you remind them or others about the sin? By the way, there's even a Gemara in Megillah that says that the Chumash should be read together with a Targum. Because in this case, by this pasuk, you don't read the Targum. We don't want to publicize the sin. So again, it's not that you can't say the Chumash is wrong. And if you're going to say that's okay, let's just take a razor, let's cut this page out and say it and take it away. But that's not what it means. Let me go back again. I think all of us now have a much better insight to understand what Reuven did. Again, I could have before said there's one of two possibilities. Reuven acts totally based upon lust. Bilhah was hot. Sorry, talking about your great-great-grandmother. Bilhah is hot. Reuven attacks her. Oh, and by the way, we never know about Bilhah's side of this also. Does he attack her? Maybe she... Again, I'm not even going there now. So we have Reuven, or there's an ideological position over here. There is a strategy involved in this. There is some other thinking which is taking place, which, again, I'm going to insist that if you just now read from that point onwards, if you notice the difference between, in that same pasuk, Yisrael and then Yaakov, you know, that just then becomes really quite remarkable, because it's a Yisrael orientation that Reuven is responding to. He's responding to the national level. And then when I compare this with what's going on in Edom, which is, again, what's right in between, so then I realize that that's the same issue which is going on over here. So let's go a little bit further and see if we could drive this home a little bit further. But first, let's understand now the implication of what Yosef did. Yosef considers B'nai Bilhah and B'nai Zilpah. What does he consider them?
Brothers.
Full brothers, which means Yosef sees all of his brothers with a sense of equality, or Reuven sees his brothers with, shall we say, a sense of different levels of social strata. Reuven, of course, would love to believe that he's on the highest level of that strata as being the firstborn. On the other hand, deep inside, he knows that there may be somebody else who's actually his greatest threat, and that person who's the greatest threat is, of course, Yosef. And what's the problem? Ela toldot Yaakov Yosef. I mean, this is the problem. And the bigger problem will come up in a moment, but this is his problem. But, as I said, the brilliance of Reuven's move was in one sweep to push four children out of contention, because they're not really brothers, and now to question their whole status. What Yosef does is he undoes what Reuven did. And if you now start to consider the collateral damage of Yosef's friendship with B'nai Bilhah and B'nai Zilpah, the collateral damage is that instead of having three different levels of strata, he tries to create one level. So here we have this equality, all or equal, while Reuven has the different strata. So by lifting up B'nai Bilhah and B'nai Zilpah, he, at the same time, he's pushing down B'nai Leah. So now he just now found himself a whole group, which is the strongest group, the six sons, and the violent sons. The six sons, these are the ones who now will be the collateral damage and be hurt by Yosef's love and friendship for the lower class. Anyway, if you look at the different ways they're looking at the family, it's just so completely different over here that this is obviously going to color what's going to happen next. Let's read the next pasuk now.
If Joseph is such a threat to Reuben, why does Reuben try to save Joseph?
That's obviously the question, and if we have time, that's where we're going to get. Pasuk Gimel. So again, the reports he brings are the reports that the sons of Leah maltreat the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah. Okay. Pasuk Gimel. V'Yisrael ahavit Yosef mikol banav ki ben zakunim hulo. V'asalok toner pasim. So, would I be correct in saying that Yaakov loved Yosef more than all of his other children? No. Because it didn't say that. What did it say? Right. So,
from all his children.
Right. So I asked, would it be correct in saying that Yaakov loves his children, loves Yosef? It says Yisrael. And that's very. And
that's the national recognition as opposed to the personal thing. But the personal thing is the color.
Maybe.
The
let's continue then. Eila told it Yaakov Yosef. Vayeshev Yaakov. Right. It's all Yaakov. And now we just now shifted. Just like we had before. And Esav is Edom. Now we have the shift that just now took place between Yaakov to Esav. In the context of the shift, what does it say? The Yisrael ahavet Yosef mikol banav. Yisrael is the one who preferred. It's the national level. It's the question of leadership. The question of if we can kingship. Ki ben zakunim hulo, which is a very difficult phrase, because normally ben zakunim, we take it to mean he's the youngest child, he's this child of his old age. He's not. Binyamin is younger. He's got a couple of brothers who are pretty close to him in age, which makes ben zakunim a very strange term, which is why if you look at the Targum Onkelos, instead of saying a ben of a zaken, he writes ben hakim. He was a wise child. Ben Zakunim, that even though he's very young, he's very wise. A Zakain is a wise person. Ben Zakunim lo. So Yisrael ahav et Yosef mikol banav ki ben Zakunim him, because he was the exactly, because he's the wisest of all the children. It's exactly what Paro says, and it's what everybody who meets Yosef notices immediately. It's what Potiphar notices, it's what the head of the prison notices, it's what Paro notices. Everybody notices, of course, for one small group of people who refuse to notice it, and that is, of course, his brothers. And then we get to the last clause in the phrase.
When they notice that he's wise, do they also use this word?
They use parallel terms. Here's a parallel term that Paro used. Paro called him, and in modern Hebrew, this is a term which has a completely different connotation. Anybody remember what Paro calls him? An avrech. So what's an avrech? It says, av b'chachma v'rach b'shanim. Somebody who's very old when it comes to wisdom and very young in age. So is Avreich the same thing as Ben Zakunim? So now you'll ask me again, did Paro use the same term? I can certainly make an argument that he makes the same observation about Yosef, that somebody can be so relatively young in years and so wise beyond his years, even though there's a major difference at that point. Over here, Yosef is 17. At that point, Yosef is 30 when he stands in front of him. But still, I would assume that most of the wise men in Egypt are people who are considerably older. Generally, you speak about the wise men being the elders, and that's why there is this correlation between being wise and being elderly, and that's why it's called Ben Zakunim. So Yosef, nonetheless, is somebody, even at a younger age, has this type of wisdom. And the last clause in the verse, Va'asalo ktonet pasim, and he made for him a coat of many colors. So the phrase ktonet pasim, or the term Ktonet Pasim, only appears at one other time in Tanakh. What is the only other time that it occurs? It is also in a situation of fraternal intrigue. It's also a situation of a king and children of kings, which should also be telling us something. The only other time it's used is David's children, David's daughter, Tamar, who was, shall we say, if Yosef is the victim of his brother's hatred, she was the victim of her brother's love. And right after Tamar was raped by Amnon, the clothing which is ripped from her, or ripped off of her, is, it's called Ketonet Pasim. And that's exactly what the Navi says, is that the reason that the Ketonet Pasim, which was worn by the children of the king, which means that the only other time Ketonet Pasim is used in Tanakh, it's specifically, deliberately, it says that this is royal garb, this is royal clothing. So when I read this whole Pasuk again, it's a coronation. This Pasuk is a coronation. The Yisrael, not Yaakov, right? I fooled you twice already. The Yisrael ahav et Yosef mikol banav, ki ben zakunim lo, vasalo Ketonet Pasim. So the context over here, again, when we go backwards, before there was a king of Israel, and I realize now that there's a competition for kingdom, at this point the competition for king really comes between two people, and those people would be Reuven and Yosef, our two firstborn. But there's a problem. And the problem, of course, is that Reuven messed up in a big way. And when Reuven messes up in such a profound way, one of the things we have to now consider is how is Yaakov going to be looking at this? And again, when I go back to this pasuk, which started off as Reuven, again, Vayehi bishkon Yisrael be'eretz ahi, Vayelech Reuven yishkavet bila pilegesh aviv, Vayishma Yisrael. So Vayishma Yisrael, and then Vayu b'nei Yaakov shneimasar. So now there's a very interesting shift there between Vayishma Yisrael and he has 12 children. No. There are many ways to explain this because this is a difficult verse, but what if the next pasuk, what if the next, the end of the verse would have said, Vayishma Yisrael? What? Vayihu b'nei Yisrael. The very next pasuk says, B'nei Leah b'chor Yaakov Reuven. That's the next pasuk. Yaakov, some Reuven retained being the Bechor of Yaakov. Of course, if it would have said the Bechor Yisrael, we would have been far more impressed. But Reuven, despite what he did not get kicked out of the house. And by the way, I think people get kicked out of the house for less in Bereishit. He did not get kicked out, which is very interesting in terms of what Yaakov may be or must be thinking. Because Yaakov could have handled this differently. By the way, once you start going in that direction and asking that, if we skip over Reuven for a second and consider Shimon and Levi, Shimon and Levi were not, you know, they did something which was not all that nice either. And Yaakov, he speaks to them. No, but he speaks to them. He speaks to them, what are you thinking, whatever. He does not accept what they did. He disagrees with them. But again, it's interesting to me that he didn't then show them the door and kick them out of the house. And listen, you guys, you guys can, you know, because of you, we can all get killed. The next step could have been, we can't harbor you here anymore. You're off on your own. Somebody wants to take revenge on you, let them take revenge on you. I'm just saying, if that would have been the next step, so none of us would have said, oh, that's so surprising, look at that. No. But Yaakov, you know, he closes ranks, this is family. Which Yaakov's message seems to be the exact perspective that Yosef ends up having. Eila told Yaakov Yosef. Yaakov refuses to kick Reuven out. He refuses to kick Shimon and Levi out, despite what they do. And later on, he's not going to kick out the brothers from Mechirat Yosef. For Yaakov, it's family. These are his family, and he's going to deal with them in easier times and harder times. This is not going to make a difference. Yaakov is not one to kick out. Again, unlike Avraham, and unlike probably Yitzchak as well. No, probably Yitzchak as well. Because again, we missed this. We missed it. When Yitzchak gave the bracha of the land of Israel to Yaakov, that's the verse I just now read. So what does Esav do? He picks up and leaves. Giving the land of Israel to Yaakov caused Esav to pick up and leave. Why? This is his father's will. His father's will is that this is not his land. So he goes and he leaves. So I'm saying, that's something which is very interesting, which means Esav's kibud av even comes to the point that he accepts the bracha that his father gave, and he says, okay, so I'm not here. So we have this separation taking place in previous generations, but we don't have the separation taking place over here. Yaakov refuses to do it. Yaakov says, these are all my sons. And the one who seems to have inherited this perspective is Yosef. And Yosef, it's a couple of times. The first time, I already pointed it out. The first time that it came up was just now. We saw it, Nishay Aviv. These are all my brothers. This is all one family, and he seems to be taking this from Yaakov. But the next time, it's far more subtle, which will go to the question that you raised before. The question which will now happen, you know, as this whole thing, this plays out, and I'm going to skip over the dreams for a moment, but you know, as the whole story plays itself out, what's going to happen next is the brothers are going to go to shepherd where they shepherd, and Yosef's going to be called by his father, go and see how your brothers are doing, which is interesting, because part of the tension here, because Yosef reports back to his father, what does his father think about that? Absolutely 100% okay with Yosef reporting on the brothers, because Yosef is the second in command. Yosef is the one who's his father's extension. Yosef is the one who's able to look and to see and bring back reports. It's exactly what his father wants there to be, which means in a reality, the rejection and the sale of Yosef is a rejection of Yaakov. You can't read it any differently. Ela told Yaakov Yosef, right? Yisrael ohav oto mikol banav. He gives him the ketonet pasim. And therefore, Yaakov has made his choice. He's keeping everybody in the family, but he's appointing Yosef. He's designating Yosef as the one who will be leader. Lefnei shemalach melech b'Yisrael. And then he sends, and this is really interesting, because he sends him from Hebron to Shechem. Any significance to those two places? Surely, we can pick on tour guides now. Any significance to Hebron and Shechem specifically? What? They're both purchased. What else? It's Beit David and it's Yosef. It's the place that will one day become the beginning of the Davidic dynasty. Will start in Hebron. David is king in Hebron for 7 years before he becomes king. This is where the Davidic dynasty begins in Hebron, which is real interesting because we just now skipped over and somehow got to Yehuda, which should be a complete surprise. On the other hand, the two places over here are Shechem. Of course, the sale does not take place in Shechem itself. It takes place in Dothan, which is Jenin, which is also not a nice place. Yeah, also not a nice place. So when he sends them, and let's skip over a little bit, and let's go to Pasuk Yud Chet, right, in your source number one. Vayiru oto mirachok, v'terem yikara v'elem, v'hulu oto lahmito. They decide they're going to kill him. But Yomer Ish El Achiv. Who is Ish and who is Achiv? So again, Pshat is that it's Shimon and Levi. The ones who are most upset at Yosef are the Bnei Leah. I know that it's not Reuven because Reuven's about to speak. I know it's not Yehuda because Yehuda's about to speak. So if I'm going back through Bnei Leah, so then by process of elimination, of course it could be Yisachar and Zvulun, but it's not. Because it's Shimon and Levi. And how I know that it's Shimon and Levi? Well, first of all, Rashi does say this, but much later on. He says this when he puts Shimon in the prison. He says, because he's the one who gave this little speech over here. But I have a different explanation. Shimon and Levi were the ones who resorted to murder in this area of Shechem the last time they had a family problem. Din is taken, let's do genocide, let's wipe out the city. Once you solve your problems by murder, that becomes a real easy way of solving your problems subsequently. So again, I'm going to say it again. When it says Ish El Achiv, I am assuming it's Bnei Leah. Why is it not Bnei Bilhah and Zilpah? Because Bnei Bilhah and Zilpah feel much closer to Yosef, which now another question emerges before we get back to Reuven. The other question that emerges is, so why Bnei Bilhah and Bnei Zilpah, why are they silent at this point? And that becomes far more interesting because they're watching this take place. The one who's been their protector is being attacked, and they're even saying, let's kill him. You know, they're there probably with their eyes wide open in complete shock. Okay, so now what's going to happen next? But, till now they've been attacked and maligned and humiliated by the children of Leah, and now by including them in this act, they will at this point become equals. Now they become regular brothers. Now they have a joint secret. Now they have leverage. Which means this is a terrible Machiavellian thought. Bill and Bnei Zilpah, who have one brother who's been protecting them, if they trade off that brother, they end up getting six brothers who now become brothers. And they, in their silence, they acquiesce to the B'nai Lea, who, again, I'm saying are the leaders. And again, if you're not happy with me saying it's B'nai Lea, the only people that speak here are B'nai Lea. The only ones who speak are by name are Reuven and Yehuda, and that's why I'm saying the other two that speak in the middle are Shimon and Levi, and they're the ones with their track record. They become actually they're the best candidates that are the ones who actually come up with the plan. It's also interesting that if it is Shimon and Levi, just notice how they bypassed Reuven, meaning Dina was also Reuven's brother. Reuven is not respected by his younger brothers. Reuven does not necessarily have all that much, sway with them. And the fact that Reuven did what he did, it's interesting how they may have looked at it or not, but Reuven does not have the status, perhaps even from the brothers, but Reuven then does something which is very unexpected. Reuven gets up and he speaks and says, no, let's save him. Now, I have a couple of questions about what Reuven will do, and let's just read the words again. We are in Pasuk Kaf Aleph, Vayishma Reuven. Right, they say, let's take him and kill him and throw him into a pit, and we'll say a wild animal ate him. But Yishmaru Uvain, Vaitzilei Miyadam. Reuven heard this. It's also interesting, the shift. Reuven sees, Vayishmaru Uvain. Reuven hears. Vayishmaru Uvain, Vaitzilei Miyadam, and he saved him. How did he save him? Vayom Elona Kenanovish. He said, he stands up, strong leadership. Okay? Here is Reuven as a leader. Stand up and says, no, we will not kill him. Now, by the way, oh, very good. We will not kill him. So this itself is surprising, and this is something that we need to understand. So let's pause over here for a second. Had he stopped right now, that would have been great, and maybe they all would have listened to him. Maybe they're laughing at him, which is why he doesn't stop now. But either way, what he says in the next pasuk, he just now, it's a weak personality. We will not kill him. And then, Vayomer leim Reuven, Al tishbechu dam hishlichu oto elabor hazeh shebemidbar, V'yad al tishlichu bo. No, I didn't mean don't kill him. All that I really mean is, let's not actively kill him. Let's do passive euthanasia on him here. Right? Leman hitzil oto miyadam l'shival aviv. But we're told what his motivation is. His motivation is in order to save him and bring back to the father. Is Rabbi Taub teaching today? Okay, so we're going to have to... finish up. So Reuven's intention is to save him. So now I have two questions on Reuven. One, why does Reuven want to save him? And second question is, why does he fail? So the reason he fails is because he's Reuven. Okay, that's why he fails. No, the reason he fails is because he's Reuven. Which, I'm going to say it again. The reason he fails is because he's Reuven. Now, the question is, why does he want to save him? Why not? So let me now go into a couple of midrashim and a couple of observations and a couple of things that we can say. One, and everything I'm going to tell you is in midrash right now. One, we're told that Yosef brought bad reports. One of the bad reports we're told is that Yosef said that he calls them avadim. The midrash goes further. Not only does he call them avadim, he was the one, Yosef is the one who told Yaakov that he slept with Bila. That's the report that he brought. And when it says, it told him Avodim, that's the small part of all this. He slept with Bila and he considers her the Pilegesh, and it, which means Yosef told this whole, meaning who goes and tells this? Yosef is the one who told over this whole thing. That's one thing. So therefore, now let's play it through a little bit. Therefore, who has the most motive to kill him? Reuven. So therefore, if Yosef doesn't come home, who is going to get accused of the crime? Reuven. So Reuven standing here and saying, hold it a second. I'm already in enough trouble. You guys kill him. I'm going to get blamed for this. The way this is normally said, because he's the oldest, he has the most responsibility. But again, that approach is taking it out of the whole context that we're seeing. So that's one thing. The second thing is, so what happened when Reuven came back? So over there we find three different interpretations. One interpretation, and Rashi brings two of them. One interpretation is that it was Reuven's turn to go back to his father and to help his father that day, which, I apologize, seems preposterous. If that was his job, so go back to your father, bring Yosef with him, save him like he wanted to. So what happened? Second interpretation is that Reuven started to cry and to pray and to fast. By the way, he's fasting, and the Targum Yonatan really spells this out. That's why he's not sitting with the other ones when they're eating, because he's fasting. Why is he fasting? He's fasting because he realizes that the sin that he did with Bilhah was a terrible sin. Why? So again, the way that I heard Rabbi Soloveitchik explained it is that these brothers are ignoring their father's will, ignoring their father, rebelling against their father. And he says, where do they get this to rebel against their father? Then he realizes that this is the trickle-down morality based upon his own behavior when he went and defied his father in either way. Either if he slept with Bill or even started deciding where his father's sleeping that night. Either way, he's the one who defies his father, and he realized that this is, again, what we can call trickle-down morality. But I found a third interpretation of the Midrash, and I know that we'll be very unused to things like this because we're not used to seeing things that are absolutely rational. In source number 5, the Psikta Zutrata Vayashav comes back to the bar. Heichon Haya, where was he? Rabbi Lezer Omer, Asukhu Besakovatanito. Right? He was busy, fasting. My wife understands it's busy. There's something to be done in the house. Busy davening. He was too busy. Right? Right. V'yesh Omrim, Halach Lavi Chevel Lahalato. He went to get a rope to get him out. Completely rational interpretation. Where was Reuven? Reuven's, he's thrown in the pit. Everyone else goes sit down to eat. Reuven is frantic now. Let me get him out of the thing. So he goes looking for a rope. He goes around looking for a rope. He comes back and Yosef is already gone. So I'm sorry that there's such a rational, illogical interpretation over here. But there's one more step to this. And there's one more midrash that tells us, so why exactly was it that, why was it? Look at the previous source. Look at source number 4 in the middle, Rabbanan. Rabbanan Amri, again, goes back to Reuven, wants to save him. Why? Omer Reuven, hu mona oti im achai ve'ini matzilo? That when Yosef said in his dreams that there were 11 stars, again, Yosef has a complete sense of equality. Reuven, whose whole status right now was questionable, am I still one of Yaakov's sons? Am I getting kicked out? I did this terrible thing, and Yosef has a dream. 11 of my brothers bow down to me, and Reuven, everyone else is saying, we're going to bow down to you. By the way, what words do they use? Hamloch timloch aleinu? Just in case you've missed the whole kingship issue again. It's right there. Are you going to be the king over us? And what's the answer? The answer is, well, yeah. But everyone else hears something negative, and look what Reuven hears. Reuven hears, that's what the Rabbanan say in the Midrash, he hears that I'm still part of the family. And he says, if I'm still part of the family, then I'm going to do whatever I can to save Yosef and keep him in the family as well.